You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
So just a bit of a trigger warning, we are talking about sexual violence and assault today. And so I spoke to the New Zealand Law Society spokesperson, Chris Macklin, who's also a Crown Prosecutor. And so just to give a bit of context, the sexual violence legislation is currently at its select committee stage, having just passed its first reading last year. And the bill is carried by Green Party MP Jan Logie and hopes to lessen the trauma experienced by victims and survivors within the justice system. In 2014, a survey indicated that 15% of New Zealanders had experienced sexual violence in their life. And also research indicated that sexual offending has incredibly low rates of reporting to police and also relatively low conviction rates. And so the Law Society stance is that they broadly support the bill's changes, however have some recommendations to make. So just quickly, the changes that the bill wants to implement into the way evidence is being presented and the way victims go through the court process, that they want to tighten rules around evidence regarding a complainant's sex life to make sure that they're protected against irrelevant and invasive questioning. They want to make sure that complainants in sexual cases are able to give the evidence in alternate ways, including pre-recording their evidence in chief and their cross-examination before the trial. The bill will also require judges to intervene when there's inappropriate questioning and to address common myths and misconceptions about sexual violence, and also extend the availability of communication assistance to any witnesses. And so I begin by asking the New Zealand Law Society spokesperson, Chris Macklin, to summarise the changes the bill is asking for.
The bill across the main acts, so the Evidence Act, the Criminal Procedure Act, and the Victims' Rights Act, is looking to make a suite of changes that further progress, I guess, an evolution towards what's perceived as a less confronting modes of evidence and ways of interacting with the court for complainants in cases that are identified as those relating to sexual violence. The bill also includes some changes for family violence complainants. And look, sadly, those two often overlap. The other area, actually, for completeness I should note, is that the Act also deals with propensity witnesses in sexual cases. So this is a situation where someone might be giving evidence about another person's propensity to act in a particular way, and it's things of a sexual nature. Those witnesses will get many of the same sorts of what are perceived as protections as a complainant would in a sexual violence case.
What does a propensity mean?
I mean, propensity is a person's tendency to act in a particular way or think or intend certain things. Something relevant, you know, a tendency to act in a particular way is a very common one, like an unusual or striking kind of way of doing your crime, be it any kind of crime, then in New Zealand we can lead evidence of that.
Mm-hmm. And specifically I wanted to also talk about what some of the criticisms the Law Society has in regards to this new legislation bill.
Well, look, broadly the Law Society, I mean, bear in mind we represent some 15,000 lawyers across the spectrum. So some are prosecutors, some are defence lawyers. The vast majority aren't in criminal law at all. So the Society's position is a mixed position in the sense there's no one consensus in terms of these reforms. So the thing that everyone can agree on, lawyers and otherwise, is that it's commendable to try and manage the stress of people who've gone, they say, through some very serious misconduct at the hands of others. And particularly sensitive, of course, are sexual violence complainants who come to the court to talk about something that by its nature is very personal. And if we're talking about offending, it's something that's very traumatic to talk about. So rather than focusing on criticisms, we commend the work that goes into mitigating or managing the stress, hopefully reducing it for people that have already been through the ringer. Having said that, there are some practical concerns. Primary amongst those is the criminal justice system is just already stretched, it seems, well beyond its limits. And we worry that some of the technical steps, recording of evidence and so on, are really just going to push an already stretched system further. And there's some principled concerns to do with balancing perceptions of fairness. So many defendants come to court, obviously they have an absolute right to a fair trial, and many of our members have expressed a concern that if the pendulum swings too far towards making it easier, these are all perception words, for people to come to court, and too far in terms of too much sympathy or empathetic presentation of complainant evidence, then that becomes unfairly persuasive or takes on an unfair precedent or priority in the courtroom. Very difficult for me, Sherry, to answer definitively because people are grappling with perceptions. So some people, I'll just give you a really quick example so you can understand what I mean. Some people will say, look, if we pre-record, so one of the major steps in the, by far and away the hottest topic in this latest suite of reforms, is a switch or greater weighting towards pre-recorded evidence. So a complainant in a sexual violence case has their entire evidence pre-recorded before the trial. And what that means is they'd be examined by a prosecutor and cross-examined by a defence lawyer before any of the rest of the trials anywhere near happening. So the idea is we'd bring it forward in the process. The victim, is, as you've phrased it, the complainant, as we tend to say in legal terms, comes to court one day, yonks beforehand in front of a judge and recorded on, I'll say video. The whole evidence is recorded rather than them waiting for a trial date for that to happen. And some people say, look, if you present just that video at court, the jury don't get a real feel for the person and what they're like answering questions and how their demeanour is and things like that. And I think it's fair to say some of my colleagues worry that would undermine a complaint. Oh, look, they're not presenting as they should, or it seems very two-dimensional. And a number of my colleagues say, well, look, my worry is the other way. It's that if you put these people on television and play a recording to the jury, it'll instinctively make it seem more real than it otherwise would, because they're seeing something on TV, and so often, especially documentary style, if you know what I mean, recording actual evidence and presenting it to someone, so often we condition in our lives these days to take on board very seriously, and there's some indications from people that we tend to believe things we see on television more than sometimes what we see in the flesh. Tell has actually got into the data. It's just perception at this point.
Because I completely understand these are obviously quite, the Law Society, you represent a whole range of people and these are some fair perceptions, but do you mind if I ask you specifically on kind of three responses to that in terms of, firstly, I guess the perception from the jury that pre-recording and evidence and having these more limitations on what kind of questions can be asked towards the complainant. The current status quo is that rape myths are being perpetuated in the courts. And so would pre-recording the evidence and having more guidance and more in terms of judges disallowing inappropriate questions, etc., would that help stop the perpetuation of rape myths happening in court?
I don't think so. And I'll answer that in a couple of ways. Mm-hmm. First, judges can already disallow questions. The reform that you've talked about is a change in one section of the Evidence Act, and it's a change from may disallow the question to must. But I'm already appearing in courts every week where questions are disallowed, and it's under that same section. So the legislators are trying to give a firmer signal like you must, but the judges have always had a discretion, and look, I can only speak to my experience, but the judges are usually pretty active with their discretion in terms of disallowing unacceptable questions. So your listeners shouldn't be under the perception that difficult or phrasing of the act is unacceptable questions are being asked. They, by and large, they're not. But I know that some of your listeners would have had the opposite experience and been asked what they deem to be unacceptable questions, and I acknowledge that must be happening, but I'm not sure if the judge is already allowing them in some courts that this change to must is going to change things, because what's acceptable and unacceptable will still be up to the judge on the day. Now, secondly, the idea of rape myths, it's one I want to hit on. Your court, and in particular the jury, so the tribunal of fact in your most serious cases, is not a court in itself. It's people just like you and me, selected at random from the community. And there's only so much that legislators, judges, and even lawyers can do, frankly, to impact on the community. So it's not, frankly, the court that perpetuates rape myths. It's popular society. And frankly, it's a culture of some elements in our society that continue to perpetuate or continue to victim blame and continue to talk in terms of people acting a certain way, meaning a certain thing, and all these sorts of common rape conceptions. And yes, some advocates will play upon those popular conceptions, but you're not going to change the jury's perception of reality, only something much broader than simply changing the law is going to achieve that. And what your listeners need to be aware of is that the current change to the directions that's intended to address rape myths is very broad, and directly addresses only three, which I can outline for you if you want, although you may already have them. So the three that are hit head-on in the current reforms is that a complainant may be at least partially responsible for sexual offending if they dress provocatively, act flirtatiously, drink alcohol or take some other drug. The second is that sexual offending is committed only by strangers or is less serious when committed by a family member. And it has a bit more detail there. And the third is that sexual offending always involves force or the infliction of physical injuries. Now, I'd hope to you and me, I mean, those myths had long been dispelled. And certainly a lot of the legal submitters at the Select Committee last week were just like, look, those aren't myths that people hold anymore. Sadly, I think there are still people in the community that hold those, but I don't think changing the law or even getting a judicial direction is necessarily the answer. Because anecdotally we hear juries being told certain things or told to ignore certain things, but what we know about human psychology is even if you consciously are trying to ignore something, if it's subconsciously set in you or if there are others among your number who are not minded to take on board what the judge is saying or whatever, then it's still going to play a role. And there are rape myths, I'm sure many listening to this could understand, well beyond the three that it's always violent or always strangers or that sometimes complainants ask for it by acting provocatively. I mean, rape myths abound, and I just think that it's our society and sort of a cultural level change that you'd need to get through rather than looking to lead from the front. It's certainly helpful, but there were already room for judges to direct on the myths, and to the extent that some of those, you know, it's horrible to say, but classic rape myths are out there, I don't know that a legal change is going to be enough to drive them out of the courtroom.
Mm-hmm. So in your opinion, you don't think the courts or the law taking a more adversarial approach is the way at the moment?
Look, that's a difficult one. The current reforms are looking to address perceived issues with juries' concepts around rape. And rather than calling them rape myths, I think it's more accurate to call them consent myths. Mm. And consent is such a difficult and personal topic that I think it's time that people, and look, I see this in some of the reporting around O Week and some of the very active reporting around the Me Too movement and so on. We, you know, I don't want to sound unduly critical. We are, as a society, talking more openly now about what genuine consent means and about when it's unacceptable to push the limits and so on. So I see this as the law more keeping up rather than the law leading the way. And you used the term adversarial. I'm not sure that this is adversarial. I think we're looking for a system that's less adversarial and more about simply getting to the truth of what really happened. And so less unacceptable questions, less showboating, this day and age, less playing upon rape myths than you'd hope. That in the courtroom, we're there just to ask what happened and test that out in a robust but fair way for all the sides.
And you also mentioned financial concerns, and I guess the courts are quite stretched thin at the moment. And I just wanted to push on that fact a bit more, just in that, is that placing victim well-being and safety after financial concerns? Would it be enough for me to perhaps suggest, like, to fix that problem, more funding and more support given into these courts rather than dismissing the whole concept of pre-recording the cross-examination?
Look, that's a really difficult one. Whenever you're asked about the public spend, you need to be very conscious, of course, that we're balancing a huge number of things. You know, that classic, I don't know if you've ever seen anyone try and spin plates, but keeping them all spinning on stage is a very difficult idea, or keeping lots of balls in the air is another one people say. And of course, at a national level, you've got health, education, and everything else screaming out. And the courts are no different, but we really are at a point now where they're very, very stretched. So most of these trials, sexual violence trials in my district, which is Rotorua, would take at least 12, more like 18, sometimes upwards of 2 years from report to trial, all right? And that's a very long time. Is it putting victim safety ahead of money? I'm not sure. I think we'd be selling the public a pup if we said that the court system is where safety is. If you're a victim, whether you've been through the trial process or not, then you are entitled to a high level of support from both the New Zealand Police and various organisations, including, of course, Victim Support, Rape Crisis and so on. And so I would hope that even if the court system, which simply gives a formal ruling as to whether someone's criminally guilty or not isn't putting people's safety at risk when it delays. But I accept that the delays that we're seeing must be putting people's safety at risk, in the sense that hanging around waiting isn't any fun for anyone and not knowing what's going on. And I know for a lot of people there's very real fear while the defendant is either on bail or in custody, but while it's still waiting to find out what's going to happen, there's a fear for them about, oh look, is he or she going to be back out in the community? Is he or she going to approach me or talk to me, or so on and so forth? So yes, that to some extent victim safety must be coming second to money. Sadly, I guess, like so much of what we expect of the public purse, it's a very fine balancing act, isn't it? Because, you know, every operation that we put off in the public health system is one that might be putting a patient at risk. And I guess in the same way, every trial that has to be put off for want of resources is putting people at risk in terms of their own safety and knowing what's going on. But I think over time we've developed things to the point, and there's a lot of work left to do, but where people realise the court process is one part of addressing this. And there's a whole lot of other wheels in motion as well in terms of social supports and so on that need to be in place. Yes, money is coming first. I guess it always is, and I don't want to be the person that says, oh, look, I could fix all of this for $3 million or $10 billion. I don't know. All I can say is that things are just really stretched, and that the resources and the equipment's not always there to have trials when we should be having them. And I don't know if that's a main cause of safety concerns, but it is a major concern in terms of fairness for everyone, because the longer these things wait to get to court, the worse people's memories are, the harder it is to find witnesses, and the more traumatic it is, frankly, to dredge it all up again and talk about it.
And I wanted to touch on the fair trial aspect as well, because I guess that was something you mentioned, in that there is a perception, perhaps I think a wrong perception, from people that the trial would be easier balanced towards the complainants. And I'm just wondering if you could discuss more on that fair trial aspect, because from my perspective, I would feel that currently the court process is already stacked up against complainants. You have rape myths that are being, or consent myths that are being perpetuated. The access to courts is already a very difficult process. The fact that resources are so limited that you have to wait so long, and so because things are so stacked up against complainants at the moment, I'm wondering if this legislation is actually slowly actually rebalancing it a bit more.
Something I want to pick up on, and it's difficult to explain, but I worry, and it's an adversarial system at court, right? There's the prosecution and then the defendant. And traditionally that was it. The complainant was just another witness in theory. And that's not right. But nor is it right to talk in terms of criminal law being the complainant or the victim against the defendant, because it's not. Very important, very sensitive and central witness, and someone that deserves the respect of the court. I'm talking about victims and complainants here. But having said that, the criminal law is not one person versus another. It's a sanction from the state talking about deeply undesirable conduct undertaken by one citizen against the state. That's why it's the Crown versus the person. It is a criminal sanction, and it can't address all the personal needs that people have. So coming to your question head on, It's not really a situation where we're trying to skew the pitch one way or the other. Fairness is all about the evidence being tested appropriately and the system having the integrity to know that only proper admissible evidence is placed before the court and weighed in the decision. So a delay or someone having a mode of evidence that they find quite testing, those are things that make it hard for a complainant to give evidence, and we want to make it easier. But it's not a situation where making it easier for a complainant necessarily skews the pitch back in their favour or something. It's not really like a sports match or something where you're one side versus the other, where one side is the victim or the complainant and the other's the defendant. So I don't know really that we can talk meaningfully about fairness and then say, oh, but it's all been this way for the benefit of the defendant. Now we're just trying to make it this way for the benefit of his or her victims, because it's not really that simple. To keep the integrity of the system, there's a few things that we've had in place for literally hundreds of years, and obviously key amongst them being the presumption of innocence and the right to silence. And what people coming into the court system and complainants in particular will perceive as unfair to them are things that are there to protect, frankly, them, their relatives, friends, brothers, sisters, so on, and others from crime at large. You know, so what I mean is it's difficult when you're in the midst of this and you're yourself a victim of crime, but the people who are alleged to have committed that crime have some deep and inalienable rights that we all have to stop the state bringing the power of the police and prosecutors like myself against them capriciously, which just means, you know, unfairly or off the top of their head. So both parties can have fairness, but it's not one versus the other. And a lot of what's perceived as unfair for complainants is actually was formulated in the absence of victim concerns, if you like, and primarily designed to stop the state unfairly prosecuting individuals and using the power or the might of the state, if you like, to undermine someone's presumption of innocence. And so if I can boil that down, it's difficult, and I understand that. I genuinely mean, for people who have been treated very badly by other people, it's horrible to see that person then sit behind a veil of silence and say, oh, I have the right to silence. But the system has to be the same for everyone. So just because you're convinced that someone committed a crime against you doesn't mean that their rights are any less than someone who might be falsely accused or someone who might have been caught out in some sort of identity mistake or something like that. And so because the rights are so important for everyone, I understand that it's perceived as unfair, but it's not meant to be tipping the scales one way or the other. It's just making sure that the state can't unfairly prosecute anyone at all. And it's because these cases are so personal and so sensitive and frankly, you know, so intimate, that they really do stir up just so much emotion. And I think we really want to make sure that we can help our complainants and their families and supporters through the emotional burden of it without unduly undermining some very important rights that we all have in any case, whether it's sexual or anything, in terms of the way that it's prosecuted before the court.
My final question today is I think we can all agree that there are some serious issues in terms of lack of access to courts, the fact that rape myths exist in our society. And so if it's not through this legislation that you see the changes coming, what would be the proposed changes that the Law Society would recommend in terms of addressing these issues?
I need to be careful answering a question about what the Law Society would recommend, because we, with a few exceptions, it'd be very seldom that we'd advocate a policy position. Our members' task and the committee that I convene within the Law Society is the Criminal Law Committee, and what we do week in, week out, is submit on changes that are proposed elsewhere in terms of workability, consistence with our constitution and so on. And so it's not really for me to say what the Law Society would recommend, and especially in such a complex area. I think it's safest for me to say, Sherry, that we're happy to see ongoing engagement at every level. And our written submission, which should now be online on the latest bill, actually says, look, we commend the Law Commission have come in behind and provide much of the background data which the legislators are working with here, and we genuinely commend efforts to try and make it easier for complainants and victims of family violence to come to court and to tell their story. I don't come here today and I couldn't advocate for you any one change, and while we have some critiques of what's going on, it would be unfair to say that we're entirely against the latest suite of changes either. It's good to take steps, and it's good to see some improvement and some dialogue in this area. I think one concern all of our members have, though, two concerns really. One is the resourcing one that you and I have talked a little bit about now. And it's, look, changes to the criminal justice system are fine, but the system even now as it stands, so-called status quo, needs a rev up. And it needs improvement in terms of court facilities and court time and the availability of judges and equipment to do what it's already supposed to do. And number two is that it's commendable to see efforts made to make court more accommodating for victims of specific types of offence, but your experience of court in terms of fairness and availability of different things shouldn't really hinge on what type of offending is alleged. I think everyone should have a fair trial on both sides at coming to court and telling their story. So any improvements look to improve either the resourcing of the criminal justice system or the experience of both defendants and witnesses of any crime would be things that the Law Society would be looking to support.
Was there anything else you wanted to add before I wrapped up for today?
No, I really want to thank you for calling it. It's great that people are remaining interested in this work and that we're having these conversations. It's really, really important to the Law Society and I think our community at large that we're not afraid to engage with the rape or consent myths and talk openly about what it means to have a fair trial. I want to apologise to your listeners because I think I've been a bit wordy in terms of explaining fair trial rights versus complainants' rights. I am a Crown Prosecutor myself and I routinely lead people through very difficult and I know genuinely traumatic evidence for them. And it's very, very harrowing to see people and hear from people who have been through some absolutely horrific things, then having to recite it in court. Mm. And I have nothing to say for that except that it's so important that people come forward and feel able to tell their story. And I hope these changes or ones like it can assist people in feeling like they can tell their story. But unfortunately, as long as we have a trial system, that is that people are presumed innocent until proven guilty, we're going to have to require people to come and give their evidence. And there's only so much that people can do to make that easier, and it's just an awfully hard thing to do. And I know that some listening will themselves be traumatised just recounting for themselves what they've been through, and they have our sympathy, and for many of our members, our deepest empathy.
And if anyone else is interested as well, I also spoke to Law Professor Elizabeth McDonald on Monday to discuss the perpetuation of rape myths in court and how structures are set up to uphold these. I also spoke to the Auckland Women's Centre, Leonie Morris, who is in support of the bill, and she responded to some of the questions brought up by Chris in regards to funding and the pre-recording of evidence. I also have a personal response as well in terms of, I guess, the argument posed in that pre-recording of evidence doesn't always get to the truth of it all, that the jury won't get a real feel of the victim. But I just want to pose a question of what is a real feel anyways, because the basis of a criminal justice system is that you have a jury that includes a portion of society that dictates the outcome. But what happens when the majority of people who are able to go serve jury duty are white and middle upper class people, because usually people from lower social economic areas have to work, and yes, in a very traditional sense, women often have the burden of looking after family members, especially if you're from a migrant community. And also, you know, with language barriers, you often don't have people from migrant communities going and serving jury duty. So you already have that kind of skew. And so with that kind of space and the fact that you have rape and consent myths existing and you have these group of people forming judgments on the complainant, what does it mean then to actually get to the truth of all? That's a question that is on my mind. I also appreciate that Chris can only admit to speaking to his own experience of cross-examination, that is his role as a Crown Prosecutor. The Women's Centre manager, Leonie Morris, said that some women that she's spoken to found it extremely belittling and demeaning, the whole cross-examination process. And so there's some contact numbers to reach out if you want to talk to someone about sexual assault or have any questions. If to talk, there's a free helpline you can ring at 0800 044 334. And the Auckland Women's Centre is also available to be reached at 09376 3227.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.